Good evening and welcome to London School of Economics. My name is Meghnad Desai. I'm an emeritus professor at the London School of Economics. It's a great honor and delight for me to be able to chair this session and welcome somebody who is one of our own. She is not a stranger. She's just come back once again to the place where she has been a student and a lecturer. And Milly Halodi is one of those people of whom LSE is very, very proud. We have a gaggle of prime ministers and presidents and ambassadors, not many of whom make it to the league of 100 most influential people in the world, as Milly Halodi has made. I still think that having an LSE PhD and having taught at LSE is an honor that cannot be equaled at all in subsequent life. I remember when Peter Bauer got his peerage, I wrote him a note saying, once you're a professor at LSE, all movements are horizontal. Anyway, so but she has managed not only to study government and politics at LSE, but now even practice it. She has been an outstanding editor of the news, a daily in Pakistan, and she has been ambassador for Pakistan in the United States, and now, of course, is the High Commissioner here. I think you come to listen to her and not to listen to me, so I'm going to stop right there while I'm ahead. And I welcome Milly Halodi, who will speak on Islam and the West, Perception and Reality.
Lord Desai, Athar, and I see so many of my friends and colleagues, in the first row at least, ladies and gentlemen, friends, colleagues, assalamu alaikum. It's really a great honor to be here. It's a great pleasure. You know, I've spent a long time in many of these buildings, but this one is new. It didn't exist when I was here. So you can imagine from that what a long time ago it was that I studied here in the government department, and I spent some time then teaching a few courses in the government department, courses in political sociology. So really it's a homecoming for me, and thank you for giving me this great honor to be back here at what I think is the greatest academic institution in the world.
We'll applaud that. We like that.
And I don't say this because it's self-serving to say this. It happens to be true. I learned a great deal from the LSE. I learned a great deal from a university that I came to, which had no campus. People used to come and visit us from Pakistan and say, okay, show us the campus. And I would have to say, this is the campus. You're looking at it. But I think the wonderful thing about the LSE always for us, for me and many of my colleagues at that time, was the great exposure it gave all of us to a wonderfully cosmopolitan city. A city, I think, which is so dynamic and which is so well known for its tolerance, for its amity, for its harmony. And in a way, you know, that brings me to the topic that I'm to speak on today, which is a subject of enormous significance. I think it is perhaps the greatest issue of our times, which is relations between the Muslim world and the West, the perception and the reality. We live, I believe, in an age, in an era of great paradoxes. As somebody so aptly put it, our world is integrating and fragmenting at the same time. Globalization, and who knows globalization better than Lord Desai here, has transformed our life and our outlook. It has created a world that is truly amazing in the way that we are interconnected. Yet we all know that it is a world that is also deeply divided. The interconnectedness of our age means that the destinies of peoples are interwoven. But as yet, there is no sense of shared interest or even common definition of what our priorities are. Priorities in one part of the world are not necessarily policy priorities in another part of the world. What is regarded as the greatest global threat in one part of the world is not necessarily the way another part of the world perceives that to be the greatest global threat. So I think the one thing that the tsunami disaster has revealed to us is our sense of shared vulnerabilities, but no commonly perceived sense of linked destinies. Global interdependence, it's obvious, has not been accompanied by the evolution of a sense of community. Unprecedented prosperity in parts of the globe stand in stunning contrast to abysmal poverty in other parts of the world. Similarly, while freedom reigns in some parts of the globe, in other parts, oppression, foreign occupation, and injustice persists. In this, what has been called the post-Google era, we can instantly access even the most obscure data should we want it. And we can have that kind of information at our fingertips. And yet, ironically, in this age of instant information and massive information, we are still confronted with a knowledge deficit. I mean this in the sense that we don't necessarily have a great deal of knowledge about each other, which can enhance or promote greater global harmony and greater understanding. The gaps in understanding in the world today and the mutual perceptions or misperceptions that exist between civilizations have yet to be bridged, they have yet to be meaningfully addressed, and in fact, the gap in understanding may be growing. We may also be living in an era in which, for no other reason than the fact that bad news is more marketable, we tend to see a situation where the media tends to give primacy to negative images over optimism, disaster over progress, and crisis over creativity. That's the nature of the modern media. That's the way it goes. My holy book, the Holy Quran, says, and I quote, "We have made you into nations and tribes so that you may know each other," unquote. Yet this process of knowing one another clearly has a long way to go. But it is also obvious, I think, to all of us in this room that in confronting contemporary challenges, no nation, no matter how powerful, no matter how preponderant, can go it alone. Only through cooperative and not coercive multilateral action can we hope to meet, to confront successfully the great challenges of our times, and to capitalize on the opportunities that globalization also opens up to us, to the mutual benefit of everyone. I put to this audience today, that this is a pivotal or defining moment in world history. Relations between the Islamic world and the West are at a critical crossroads. If action is not taken, purposeful action is not taken, there is a real danger of what President Musharraf calls an iron curtain descending between the Islamic world and the West. Efforts, as I said before, so far to bridge the gap in mutual understanding have been modest. Negative images of each other persist and influence perceptions on both sides. And these problems of mutual perception and stereotypes have persisted so stubbornly that they continue to provide a profound basis for misunderstanding. There has also been a growing tendency in recent years to see each other through caricatures. People in the Muslim world, and of course I'm generalizing, so there are many of you who can get up and say, well, I don't agree with this, but I have to adopt certain generalizations. People in the Muslim world generally have tended to see the West as technologically advanced, militarily powerful, politically untrustworthy, economically exploitative, socially materialistic, and morally, shall we say, challenged. In the Western world, images of Muslims have been, and again, this is the way certain perceptions go, people who are politically repressive, economically underdeveloped, militarily weak, scientifically backward, religiously fanatical, socially anti-modern, and morally absolutist. But in reality, these caricatures or images are a blend of myth and reality, and therefore erroneous and misleading, and certainly not a basis on which to formulate policy or responses at the policy level. I think we live in dangerous times because perhaps for the first time in contemporary history, several world civilizations feel they are under siege. Not one, but more than one. Muslims feel they are under siege today, whether it is the Muslim diaspora living in the West, or Muslims living in Muslim countries, or in secular countries. They feel they are under siege. And many countries in the West also feel that they are under some kind of siege. In the West, we constantly hear about the Islamist threat. But many people in the Muslim world feel that Islam is under threat. So the great challenge is how to remove this gap in mutual understanding and how to promote inter-civilizational harmony. So let me turn to how we got here and where to go from here. But before I do that, I think I have to say something that I'm sure everybody will agree with, which is that we must factor in the tremendous internal variation both within the Islamic world and the West, and therefore avoid the mistake of treating both as monoliths. For example, it is often overlooked that 3/4 of Muslims in the world live beyond the Arab countries. Indeed, the two largest Muslim nations in the world are Indonesia and Pakistan, respectively. So people in the West need to be careful not to generalize about the Islamic world, which is marked by extraordinary diversity. Similarly, we in the Muslim world, or we Muslims, also need to take a more nuanced view of the West. And images that treat the other as a monolith are obviously conceptually flawed, and we should resist trying to see the other through that prism. Turning now to the historical sources of Muslim alienation or a sense of Muslim injury vis-a-vis the West that has grown in the post-World War II era, much, if not virtually all of this sense of Muslim injury is attributable to the conduct of policy by certain leading Western nations. The general perception of people in the Muslim world for the last half a century has been to see the West as applying and implementing principles on a rather selected or eclectic basis, and also applying what they regard as double standards. For example, while self-determination has been regarded as an inviolable right for others, it has been seen to have been ignored in the case of Palestine or in the case of Kashmir. And what has exacerbated such negative sentiments in the Muslim world is the widespread perception, again, you know, we're talking of perceptions here, of perception of Western indifference or lack of sensitivity to issues that are close to Muslim hearts and Muslim minds. And of course, Palestine is the classic case in point. Across the Muslim world, and when I say across the Muslim world, it literally is across the Arab as well as the Muslim world right up to Indonesia, people have seen Western policy in the last half a century to have been unjust, one-sided, lack of balance, and inconsistent with the declared objective of promoting regional peace and regional justice in the Middle East. The tolerance that has been seen for continuing dispossession and repression of the Palestinian people, even as Western nations declared that it wanted to secure the rights of Palestinians, has been used, or it has been something that people in the Muslim world have pointed to repeatedly and as an example of double speak, double think, or whatever you want to call it, but certainly something that people across the Muslim world have seen with a great sense of hurt and injury. And by allowing Israel to annex larger slices of the West Bank, the US-led Western community has unwittingly swelled the ranks of radicals in the Muslim world. There is no question about that. We've seen that happen in the region from where I come from, and we've seen that happen elsewhere also. The Iraq war itself has created quasi-occupied territories that have been seen in the Muslim world to be the cause of resentment, and again, a deepening sense of injury. But the turning point really in the contemporary radicalization of the Muslim world ensued from the region of which Pakistan is a part. And it ensued from the 1979 Soviet, then Soviet, invasion or occupation of Afghanistan. I don't want to spend a great deal of time tracking that history from 79 onwards, but I think it's important to recognize that it was at that juncture that Western nations, in order to roll back the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, decided that the best resistance that ought to be offered to Moscow ought to be offered by presenting and waging the liberation of Afghanistan, the battle for freedom of in Afghanistan, as a religious struggle or a jihad. And this decade-long war against the then Soviet Union saw, as I'm sure many of you know, billions of dollars pour in to support and train militant Mujahideen fighters. The militant Mujahideen fighters were in fact held up as great beacons of forces that were fighting for the freedom of the entire world. Pakistan, my country, became a base and a destination for millions from across the Arab world who came to fight this valiant jihad, who came to become these valiant warriors for freedom. And many of them were never to return home once the Afghan war ended and once the Soviet invasion was rolled back. Indeed, many of those who came at that time stayed and turned to other pan-Islamic causes once the war had ended. In fact, very few returned home. At the same time, it was at this juncture that the number and complexion of madrasas or religious schools in Pakistan began to change as these began to receive unprecedented levels of foreign funding to help provide recruits as well as sanctuary for those fighting this holy war in Afghanistan. To give you an example of what was happening in Pakistan during this decade of the 80s, in 1947, when Pakistan became an independent nation, there were only about 130-odd madrasas in Pakistan. And in the 50s, these had grown to just about 200, not much. But it was in the 1980s that the numbers multiplied, proliferated. The numbers grew exponentially, so that current estimates put them around 13,000 religious schools or madrasas now in Pakistan. Many of these madrasas, not all obviously, became politicized and radicalized to serve political ends during the Afghan war. And certain religious and militant parties involved in the Afghan jihad began to control and run their own madrasas. This was only part of the fallout in Pakistan after this long Afghan war. But the international community, once the Soviet occupation ended, walked away. Walked away because their war was over. But the militancy that was fueled by this long war stayed. It was allowed to fester for another decade, seeking new allies and finding new pan-Islamic causes, as it were. Post-9/11 dynamics further exacerbated the situation. The trajectory and lexicon of the war on terror began to create an impression in large parts of the Muslim world that somehow And this is again a perception. The reality may be different, but the perception that was created by the lexicon particularly was that somehow this war was targeting Muslims, and it was a war on Islam itself. And this perception was strengthened by certain voices of the religious right in the West, as indeed by militants also in the Muslim world itself. Interestingly, both seem to converge in a certain way, unwittingly of course, to create or to reinforce an impression that this was a war targeted at Muslims and it was aimed at somehow weakening the Muslim world. Of course, what compounded the whole situation was the fact that some governments began to use the label terrorist to snuff out critical scrutiny of its strategy or its actions. And once this label was used as a sweeping brush to tar every kind of resistance and insurgency, it had two consequences. First, virtually all violence in situations involving Muslims, irrespective of whether this was in response in self-defense or a response to state-sponsored aggression or repression of foreign occupation, was seen and cast in criminal terms. And second, applying the term loosely and broadly produced a faulty assessment of the challenges being faced by Muslim societies. And of course, it also led to flawed identification of the tools that were needed to deal with these challenges. One, for example, of the most erroneous notions that figured in the rhetoric of the war on terror was that perpetrators of violence hate the West for its freedoms and loathes it for its values. I'm quoting part of the language or rhetoric that has accompanied the war on terror, that the perpetrators of the violence hate the West because of its freedoms and because of its values. In my opinion, nothing could be further from the truth. This is simply plain wrong. Certain policies have ignited anger and resentment in the Muslim world, but it is not Western freedom or Western values that is being resented or opposed by people in the Muslim world. And I think it's interesting that endorsement of this analysis, the hypothesis that I have put forward, has come recently from what is called the Defense Science Board, which is a federal committee of academics and strategists that gives independent advice to the Secretary of Defense in the United States. The DSB, as it is called, was asked to study U.S. strategic communications policy. And its report found that good presentation would do nothing in building support for policies that were widely resented in the Muslim world. This did not come as a surprise to many of us, but I think it was interesting that a group of people in the United States itself found that it was not a question of giving policy a makeover, it was a question of examining that policy itself that was required in order to build greater support for those policies in the Muslim world. I think against this backdrop, it would be instructive to look at the state of the large Muslim diaspora in the West and the impact that post-9/11 rhetoric and practice have had on the 13 million Muslims living in Europe, for example. The majority of these Muslims have increasingly begun to feel that they have experienced rising discrimination after 9/11. They refer to Islamophobia that they now believe characterizes many Western nations. A recent study, for example, found that 80% of the 1.8 million Muslims in the United Kingdom felt they had been discriminated against because of their faith, compared to only 35% who felt this way in 1999. This is a survey that was carried out by an organization called the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And one of the authors of this report put it as follows, and I quote from what he said. What's happened post 9/11 is that some very deeply rooted prejudices, things that were not articulated in the public realm, have now found expression, unquote. Another recent survey is just as disconcerting, because this survey found that in some EU countries, disapproval of Muslims topped 70%, while overall 52% of Western Europeans said there is a lot of disapproval of Muslims living in Europe. Polls in the United States have also found distrust of Muslims may be becoming commonplace. A national poll conducted by a Muslim advocacy group found that 1 in 4 Americans held a negative, stereotype view of Muslims. But more alarmingly, another poll found that nearly half of all Americans believe their government should restrict the civil liberties of American Muslims. The survey that was conducted by Cornell University also found, interesting, that those who were exposed to television news were more likely to support limiting the civil rights of American Muslims. And I think this, in a way, focuses our attention of the enormous power of the media, about which, you know, I can hardly emphasize the role that the media can and does play, mostly unwittingly, in promoting certain stereotypes. Particularly television tends to reinforce stereotypes rather than to challenge them. And I think this is part of the challenge that we all have to deal with. How do we surmount and overcome some of these stereotype views when day in and day out our life in a context or an environment which is dominated by the 24-hour round-the-clock news channel culture? How do we overcome this? It's tough. It's not easy. Now, to turn to the Muslim world, I think the question that is asked a great deal, I certainly found that this was a question that many people asked me when I served as my country's representative in America, and now that I serve in this country, which is, what is it that Muslims want? Muslims in the Muslim world, what is it that they're looking for? What do you guys want? I repeatedly hear this. Maybe they don't quite put it in those stark terms, but that's a question that's on their minds. And I think the answer to that is a very simple one. And I almost want to say, sorry to disappoint you, but the simple answer to that question is that the aspirations of Muslims in the Muslim world are no different from aspirations of people anywhere in the world. They want a decent life for themselves. They want food, clothing, shelter, education, security, freedom. 1.5 billion Muslims living in 57 Muslim nations, if somehow a survey could be carried out of all these people, I think the findings would be very simple. The findings would be that their aspirations are similar to the aspirations of people in the rest of the developing world, which is to break out of poverty, illiteracy, and economic and political underdevelopment. And this really underlines and underscores that the Muslim world itself has to live up to the challenge of meeting these aspirations and these expectations of their own people. So this imposes a great responsibility on governments in the Muslim world, because if they are unable to address their people's aspirations and meet their people's expectations, they risk provoking opposition, which often uses religion as its expression and as its mobilizing vehicle, and can also assume an extremist nature. The challenge is an imposing one. The challenge is truly formidable. Because while the Arab world has made considerable progress, the UNDP's Arab Human Development Report of 2002, I'm sure many of you would have come across this report, it was written entirely by Arab scholars and Arab authors, identified 3 key deficits in the Arab world. And these 3 key deficits it named as follows: the governance or the freedom deficit, the women's empowerment deficit, and third, the knowledge deficit. And the Arab authors of this report, this very influential report, argued that these deficits in gender empowerment, freedom, and education were retarding progress and modernization in the Arab nations. And yet, to raise the question of values, a second Arab Human Development Report cited the World Value Survey to show that Arabs top the world in believing that democracy is the best form of government, way ahead of people elsewhere in the world. And yet when Muslims look at where they are, some of this frustration and anger is unavoidable, because when they look at their own situation, it is not very edifying. The world's 57 Muslim states, which account for over a fifth of humanity, have an average literacy rate of under 50%. The human development indicators in the Muslim world are amongst the lowest in the world. While possessing 70% of the world's energy resources and having 40% share in the global supply of raw material in the world, the combined share of Muslim countries in global trade is a mere 6 to 8%. The collective GDP of the Muslim world is a mere 5% of global output. Indeed, the total GDP of all OIC states, which are all the members of the Organization of Islamic Conference, is less than half that of Germany. There are about 550 universities in the Islamic world, whereas Japan alone has 1,000. And if we ask the question in the Muslim world, ask ourselves that question, how many Nobel laureates come from the Muslim world? We don't get a very happy answer. This dismal picture is a reality. But then this harsh reality is compounded by a global system that exacerbates this picture, that exacerbates the suffering. Certainly the Muslim world, governments and society alike, have a great deal to do, a great way to go, many miles to go, to reform themselves to become contemporary, and to specially reclaim their knowledge-producing heritage. Islam emphasizes the pursuit of knowledge over and over again in the Holy Book. Muslims are asked and exhorted to seek knowledge. And yet this is where the Muslim world has perhaps lagged the most. And in this globalized era, in which the currency of exchange, as indeed of power, is knowledge, the most critical transformation that is waiting to happen and that the Islamic world has a responsibility to make is from being mere recipients of knowledge and technology to becoming active participants in creating the new. This means unleashing a grand renaissance of intellectual and scientific thought that can become the vehicle for the Muslim world's socio-economic emancipation. This obviously is not going to be easy, nor is it a task that can be undertaken overnight. Creating a culture of learning is a painstaking process, but there are no shortcuts, and the Muslim world has to recognize that, and efforts that it has to make in this behalf are obviously urgent. But these steps cannot be taken in isolation. Reforms in the Muslim world must be accompanied by concrete and meaningful change in the conduct of foreign policy by key Western countries. Because if these policies are seen to be dogmatic and unilateral in the Muslim world, sometimes appearing to mirror the hardline stance of extremists in the Muslim world, then those who want reform, renewal, and progress in the Muslim world will lose out. They will become increasingly marginalized, and attitudes will harden in the Muslim world. Indeed, those trying to create a moderate space in the middle will be dubbed as apologists of the West, and extremists on both sides will drive our civilizations apart, and an iron curtain will truly descend between two civilizations. But as we search for ways to forge a better accommodation between the West and the Muslim world, there has to be a recognition that the West cannot fight terrorism or deal with the new security threats of the 21st century on its own any more than the Muslim world can deal by itself with the challenge of violent extremism. In other words, our destinies are interlocked, and only by collective action, action that is underpinned by consensus and agreement, can we effectively confront these problems. For a start, the global coalition waging the war on terror must recognize and address the root causes. That combustible mix of political injustice and economic deprivation that fuels feelings of powerlessness, despair, and hopelessness, that in turn provides the breeding ground for violent extremism. without addressing the root causes, the war against terror cannot and will not succeed. My country has been on the front lines in this war on terror. But in waging this war, we have repeatedly, constantly pointed out to our partners the fact that root causes must be addressed. Second, that we must be careful in our terminology and in our rhetoric, because we mustn't let terrorism be identified with a single faith. And we've also pointed out repeatedly, and we continue to do that, the war on terror must not become an excuse or a pretext for certain nations to suppress legitimate freedom struggles or to compromise or abridge civil liberties. Because if you compromise on freedom yourself, what is it that you're upholding against those who seek to take freedom away? So we cannot fight those who use terror as an instrument or as a tactic with the same weapons and with the same tools. Which brings me to the final point that we constantly keep making in this war on terror, which is the war on terror is above all a war that has to be fought on multiple fronts and by different instruments and different tools. Military means are merely one instrument and not necessarily the most important. The war and the battle for hearts and minds is far more important, even though we have to deal with people of violence and we have to use force from time to time, but force alone is not going to win this battle. My country has offered a way forward. President Musharraf has enunciated the concept and strategy of enlightened moderation, what he calls enlightened moderation, to advance the internal and external aspirations of the Muslim world and to help promote greater harmony between the Islamic world and the West. What are essential ingredients of this strategy are tolerance, dialogue, socio-economic progress and emancipation, human development, and of course, just and peaceful resolution of disputes. The concept rests on two prongs, as it were. The strategy has two prongs. One prong is to be delivered by the Muslim world by shunning militancy and extremism and pursuing the path of socio-economic progress. And the other has to be delivered by the West and the United States in particular. And this involves two things. First, to resolutely help secure just solutions for political disputes that happen to be located or situated in the Muslim world, Palestine and Kashmir being cases in point, and also to assist the Muslim world in its internal strategy of socio-economic reform and educational development. The strategy of enlightened moderation that we are pursuing in Pakistan itself is predicated on the belief that the root causes of militancy and extremism lie in the combination of the lethal mix that political injustice and economic deprivation often produces. It's these conditions that breed people of violence that we must seek to transform. And for Western nations, there is a need to evolve a new strategy to engage with the Islamic world, a new strategy to engage Islam. And this must start with the acknowledgement that Muslim values do not pose a threat to the core values of Western society. The problem lies not in any clash of values, but in recognizing Muslim resentment of certain policies, historically and in also the contemporary context. Ending foreign occupation where it exists and helping promote an alternate approach that focuses on root causes provides a way forward. The West needs to act thoughtfully and meaningfully. And a critical area of action should ensue from recognition of the common sense principle that global security cannot be separated from issues of trade, development, and poverty. Security cannot be attained at the global level or the regional level or at the national level when economic and social stagnation and inequity threaten national, regional, and global peace. A fairer world is also a more secure world. An unfair world can never be a secure world. But to make the world fairer, we need to make trade fairer. For years, developing countries, including those in the Muslim world, have been told that the only path to prosperity was by opening up their markets, by trade liberalization. And while poor countries heeded this advice, including Pakistan, which dismantled many of their trade barriers, rich Western countries, in our opinion, have yet to fully reciprocate what we have done. In precisely the sectors where developing countries, including my own, have a comparative advantage, including agriculture and textiles, rich Western nations have protected themselves through tariff and non-tariff barriers and extensive systems of domestic subsidies. Agricultural subsidies, of course, are a case in point, well known in the European Union. This has, of course, resulted in dumped exports. At the same time, it is quite extraordinary that U.S. free trade deals have included very few Muslim countries. In other words, the U.S. has forged very few FTAs with Muslim nations. An extraordinary demonstration of how out of sync policy can be with its own national security goals. There is little doubt, certainly in our minds, in Pakistan, that the single most significant way in which economically advanced Western nations can help the Muslim world, as indeed developing countries in general, is to give them access to their markets. According to the former MD of the IMF, Mr. Kohler, and I quote, "Protectionism in industrial countries is the core problem in the fight against poverty. Export barriers are often four times higher for developing countries than for rich countries. These barriers cost poorer nations around $100 billion a year, about twice as much as they receive in aid or assistance. The World Bank has estimated that a deal to open up rich Western countries, their markets, to poorer nations could extricate up to 144 million people from poverty by the year 2015. To give you an example in a very tangible way of what market access can mean to a country like Pakistan, every $1 billion of additional exports that my country can make, every $1 billion of exports yields 200,000 jobs in Pakistan, which affects 1.5 million people. That's a lot of people who are suddenly given promise of a better tomorrow because you're making trade fairer. And that is a point that we constantly emphasize to our friends in the West, that we seek not your aid or your charity, we seek a fairer deal. And the best way that you can help us and yourself in the process is to ensure that you open up your markets in an equitable way, as we open ours to you, to ensure that we have a level playing field in the trade realm. Because world trade is perhaps the most powerful instrument that can be used to attack and reduce poverty across the world. So let me try to round off by saying that it's pretty obvious that we need to build bridges of trust and cooperation and understanding. But none of this is going to happen unless there is strong political will. I mean, the need could not have been greater. The need is urgent. And I don't believe there is any clash of values that is responsible for the gulf that we find today. I'm pretty clear that the culprits are policies, economic and political, that urgently need to be reevaluated, reformed, and recast. So let me conclude with the hope that the Muslim world and the West can negotiate this turbulent period together and in agreement, and that both find the courage in themselves to make the changes that are necessary, because changes are required on both sides. One won't work without the other. And the changes that are required are changes in their policies and changes within their societies. There is an old proverb that says, there are no roads, they're only made by walking. The question, therefore, is, are we ready to walk together? I certainly hope so, because I think the alternative is too fearful to contemplate. And I think each one of us has a role to play, and it is a responsibility, I think, that devolves on each one of us to be actively involved in fashioning an environment where hope trumps fear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Your Excellency. Now, we will have questions from the audience. And by questions, I mean questions, not statements. Do not summarize what the speaker has said and then add your question. We all heard her. Keep your question short, only one question per person, and introduce yourself audibly. Okay. Person at the back there. Yeah, you, yeah. Gentlemen here.
Yeah, my name is Dylan, and I'm an activist in civil liberties and human rights and anti-war movement. You mentioned about paradoxes. One is that the illegal occupation of Iraq, the war that's taking place, has brought the focus that the world is polarized in two parts.
What's the question?
Those who stand, I'm going to ask the question, stand for justice against that war and in defense of the persecution of the Muslims being persecuted like the Jews were before the Second World War, and those who support the war. Similarly, it's crystallized the government's agenda. The paradox pointed out is, why is it that we stand up, the Indian government and the Pakistan government has been in support of the war, in violation of the fundamental core values of Islam and the other religions, standing for justice in defense of freedom
okay.
and
independence. No. That's already far too long. I told you not to summarize what the other thing. No, you asked your question. No, please. No, you're taking people's time. Gentlemen there. Yeah, you, yeah. Somebody, yeah, that gentleman there, yeah. Okay, thank you. Sorry, do you want to answer them now?
No, we'll take one more.
One more. I'm really looking for a woman to ask a question. Only men are asking questions. This is terrible.
There's one here.
Okay.
Yeah?
No?
No,
over here. Okay, gentleman there. The red. Yeah. Stand up.
The impact of political pressure and how by regimes of Americanism, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and do you see any parallels with Pakistan's attempt to bypass radicalism in Pakistan by the force of American pressure?
Okay, I hope you heard that. Okay. I'm going to answer these five questions and we'll ask some more. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, I have quite a mixed bag here.
Oh.
Let me see what I can do. First question, I think, has to do with Kashmir. And I think the point I made was that we cannot use the terrorism label to paint legitimate freedom struggles as terrorist, which certain, you know, we've seen attempts being made in that direction. I think we've got to be very clear here what we're dealing with. We know what terrorism is. We know what terrorism is. Terrorism is... So, is that okay? India and Pakistan today are talking to each other. We are in the midst of what you rightly called a composite dialogue, which basically means that we're discussing a whole basket of issues. But I think the first part of your question where you said, you know, militancy, and I think there was some, what, from what I understood of your question, was that we have to distinguish between terrorism and freedom struggles. And I think we cannot expediently try to use the war on terror, and that's precisely the point I was trying to make earlier, which is we must be careful that this is not misused, I should say, to cast legitimate freedom struggles in a certain manner. So as far as Pakistan is concerned, we are committed to the peace process. We seek a peaceful resolution of the Kashmir dispute. We have always sought that, but we have also maintained that unless the peace process begins to yield something in a result-oriented way, the substance is more important than process, you're not going to see radicalism go down or violence in Kashmir go down. People who have turned to violence must see some light at the end of the tunnel. It's only when they start seeing light at the end of the tunnel that you see historically violence going down, be it Northern Ireland or be it the Middle East peace process. You know, I think all those who are students of history will agree that in most instances, if not all, peace processes, if they're seen to be legitimate and going somewhere, you will see that men and women of violence will put down their arms and turn to a peaceful methods, because they know that something will come at the end of that process.
Shh, no, please.
Militancy is a product of something. I think, yeah, I mean, I won't get into a long spiel on this, but I think we have to be very clear, because I know where you're getting at. And I think I do want to say that the tragedy of Kashmir stemmed from the denial of the right of self-determination to the people of Kashmir. Terrorism was an outcome of that. Terrorism did not create the tragedy of Kashmir, but the denial of self-determination to the people of Kashmir and foreign occupation created the tragedy of Kashmir. So I think we must be clear about the sequence in which things have happened, otherwise we won't have the prescriptions to apply to them. Now, you asked a question about Iraq and how it was polarizing. I think what I was trying to say in some of my own remarks was that there have been many issues out there that have had a polarizing impact. And as far as Pakistan is concerned, I think you probably not noticed, or perhaps you're not aware of the fact that my country was a non-permanent member of the Security Council when the Iraq debates were going on in the Security Council. And the stance that Pakistan took was very clear. We advocated a diplomatic resolution of the crisis in Iraq, and we were not an advocate of the war. Our record at the Security Council is a testimony of that. So as far as we are concerned, even now, we constantly advocate peaceful diplomatic ways to resolve crisis, be they in Iraq or elsewhere in the Muslim world. We do not believe that resort to force is the way to go. But I think at this point in time, we have to look ahead, and we have to look at, you know, how the elections in Iraq will proceed and whether they will lead to greater stability in the Middle East. So I think I will leave that there by actually correcting setting the record straight in terms of where Pakistan stood on the war. Somebody asked a question about whether, you know, those certain political organizations that have a certain message can fill a vacuum. I think that's a judgment only you can make. I think political parties, provided they do not resort to violence to espouse or advocate or to, you know, attain their objectives, you know, they have a right to say whatever they want to, but they also should respect the others' point of view as well. I think that's the question that you asked me, and I'm trying to address it in the manner that if there is an organization out there that advocates a certain thing, the one thing that is fundamental about Islam is that there is no coercion. One of the most important Quranic verses relates to the fact that there is no coercion in religion. Therefore, there ought to be no coercion in those or among those people who advocate a certain way of life. There cannot be any coercion, because that would be inimical to Quranic texts themselves and to what our religion itself advocates. So I think if you want the freedom of speech, you have to respect and accept the freedom of speech of others also. I will give you one little example. My country, because I know that hijab is a big issue in Europe, my country, for example, does not force or coerce people to do either. people are free to either cover their heads and they're free not to cover their heads. The state does not get involved in that, and I think we have followed the right path by not coercing people to do one or the other, leaving it to them as a matter of personal choice and personal preference. Okay, I think I'm pretty much done. There was another question on the impact of the lack of freedom on radicalism. Yeah, I think, you know, that's why I was citing what Arabs themselves had said about their agenda or their requirement. And I think in identifying the freedom deficit or the governance deficit, this UNDP report very clearly underscored the need to address this as part of reforms that are required in the Muslim world. But I think, you know, the one thing I would like to say is I think we have to see this as a process where many of these policy measures are, you know, they can't be taken in isolation. You can't expect one to do just one set of measures and start expecting that to yield. I think the West has to play its part. The Muslim world has to play their part. The Muslim world has a responsibility to undertake certain actions and certain reform measures within their societies, not because anybody's asking them to, but because their people are asking them to. And I think the question you raised about Pakistan, not you, but somebody else raised about Pakistan being coerced by somebody to do ABC, my country doesn't get coerced, let me tell you that. It doesn't get coerced because if it did, my country would not have an independent nuclear deterrent capability. Every nation in the West, through embargoes, sanctions, and all sorts of measures, sought to stop Pakistan's quest for security. And ours was a security response. In response to what our neighbor had done, we didn't have a choice. If our foreign policy had not been independent, believe me, Pakistan would have had no nuclear program. So I think I would examine that before I make a remark that, you know, Pakistan is doing this under pressure. And secondly, let me say that our efforts at promoting enlightened moderation in Pakistan, at ensuring that terrorism is eliminated from Pakistan, stems from Pakistan's own national interest and from our sense of religious obligation. Islam prohibits violence against non-combatants. In Islam, again, let me quote to you something that is in our holy book, which says, the taking of one innocent life is like the murder of all of humanity. That's where we're coming from. Our religion, our conscience, our national interest, all of these converge to enjoin on us the need to eliminate terrorism, because terrorism targets innocent people, and we do not agree with that. We condemn that. And there are no ifs and buts in our condemnation of terrorism. But at the same time, we also say, as I have tried to explain to you, that it is not enough to simply use military force or force to eliminate terrorism. We must look at transforming the conditions that produce people of violence as a long-term strategy. Without that, there is no war on terror that can be won. And that is something we keep telling our coalition partners, be they powerful ones or be they regional ones, be they whoever they may be. We have said this loud and clear.
Okay, we'll take another clutch of questions. Gentlemen here. Yeah. Gentleman there, at back there, yeah. Can you speak up?
Okay, so my name is Muhammad Khan. I'm from Bernard University. I'm studying information systems. Now, my question is, Pakistan claims to be an example of Islam. But Pakistan is a secular state, and Islam and secularism are not compatible. Also, Pakistan's constitution is based on secularism. So we need to know what Dr. Nadeem has to say about this. Thank you.
Okay. The lady there. You have your hand up, yeah. Please.
What is some of the?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gentleman back there. Yeah. Yes, you, yeah. Yes. Get up. What's the question?
I think let me take that question first, because I think you raise a very important point. And I think what I was, you know, I don't want to get into a blame game, because I don't think that's useful. What I was trying to point out was that contemporary radicalization of our region and parts of the Muslim world, actually the trajectory leads back to the Soviet occupation and the kind of resistance that was offered to that occupation. And in making that point, what I wanted to underscore was essentially that this was the law of unintended consequences. Mm. I don't think people set out to do what we found at the end of the process. I think people had good intentions. I think my own country, which was on the front lines in this war to roll back the presence of the Red Army from Afghanistan, also had good intentions. But I think many of us did not realize, but you know, now it's important for us to recognize that so that we are able to ensure that down the road, as we battle terrorism and as we battle many other forms of violence in the world today, we do not, at least we do not repeat some of the things that occurred at that time. So in other words, we are sure, more sure than we were at that time in terms of the consequences of the actions that we take today. So the reason we recall history is, one, to understand the phenomena, and two, to ensure that certain mistakes that were made at that time are not repeated. I think that is the most valuable lesson that we can draw from the history of that period. So I do think that when you say, why couldn't anything have been done at that time, simply because people didn't see that this is where it would all lead to. You know, at that time people thought, many Muslim countries were also sending in people, there was funding coming in and so on. I think people thought at the end of that process, once the Soviets withdrew, that everybody would also pack their bags and go home. That didn't happen because of the radicalization that took place, and because many of these people really didn't have homes to go to some extent. I mean, we in Pakistan, for example, expected that the Afghan refugees would all go back. They're still in my country, a large bulk of them. They were close to 3.5 million at that time. And now, even now, they're over 1.5 million in Pakistan. So, I mean, that is also part of what our expectation was at that time and what actually came to pass. So I think the point that I'm trying to make is that we need to take stock of where we are right now so that we ensure that in the future we understand what the sources of militancy are, where did they come from. Because if we don't understand that, we won't be able to address these sources of militancy. And to also ensure that there are no new sources of militancy that are created as we go along. Somebody asked a question about, I think, Hindus, and I think somebody also asked about this, the state of Christians living in Pakistan. The you know, minority protection or protection of the rights of minorities is enshrined in Pakistan's constitution. Having said that, it is also true that actions have taken place at a time when, you know, the forces of intolerance, forces of darkness, sometimes do take matters into their hands and begin to launch attacks against people belonging to a minority sect. This is something that the state of Pakistan takes very seriously, and it comes down very hard on those who have tried to either preach hatred and not just against another, another religion, but also against one Muslim sect against another. We've seen that happen too. Pakistan has also witnessed sectarian violence where, you know, different sects within the Muslim faith have also been slugging it out, as it were, in certain cases. So there has been violence in that regard. But I think the good news is that since the state sent a very strong signal that it will not permit this behavior, and that if this behavior in a way was ignored in the past, that will no longer be the case. The state will not permit two or three things. First of all, it will not permit those who are spewing hatred against anybody, irrespective of what faith they belong to. That is something that is not going to be, there's zero state tolerance for that. And second, to be able to, I think the message that's gone out again by the state itself is that it wishes to promote, by promoting enlightened moderation, it's saying precisely this, that we have to learn to coexist, we must learn to respect each other, we may belong to different faiths. And I think going back to the words and principles of our founding fathers in Pakistan envisaged a state where all citizens, irrespective of caste, creed or religion, would live and coexist as equal citizens in the eyes of the law. So I think going back to basics, recalling what Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Qaid Azam, the founder of Pakistan, said, that's all been part of a process. Now, that leads to the question whether we're satisfied with where we are. Of course we're not. We have much further to go. We have much more to do to be able to promote the kind of environment and the kind of culture which will be, in a way, a translation of Jinnah's vision. We're not there yet, but we're certainly clear about the road that we're taking, and we will not diverge from that road. The state has also made clear that it will not permit armed militias on its territory. It's come down very hard on those political parties that had organized armed wings. The state is saying, sorry, you can't question the writ of the state, so we will crack down, and we have cracked down. These are not easy things to do, but they've been done. And it will take a while, and I think some of the issues that I tried to highlight was that, you know, the more that we're able to promote education, the more there is literacy in Pakistan, the more there is socioeconomic development in Pakistan, all of that together will create an environment where we will really be able to actualize Jinnah's Pakistan or Jinnah's dream or Jinnah's vision for Pakistan. But so far, I think the last 5 years, 6 years have seen us take very important strides forward at a very difficult time. Please do not underestimate the crisis that we've been through. 5 years ago, my country was on the verge of insolvency. We were about to default on external debt. We were caught up in a debt trap. Then comes 9/11, and we're in a war zone. And we are hit because we're in a war zone. War risk insurance premium goes up, and exports from Pakistan start getting cancelled. I was in the United States when I had loads of people just phoning me saying, our orders have been cancelled. People calling from Pakistan saying orders from America had been cancelled. This is tough. This is not easy. And at a time when, in a way, the whole world's focus was on Pakistan. So here we are negotiating peace with India on the one hand, because, you know, in the midst of all of the actions that we were taking, we also had this military standoff between Pakistan and India, where close to 1 million troops were massed on our borders. Here is a country struggling to make itself solvent on a viable basis, to ensure that the war on terror is conducted in a manner that minimizes casualties, civilian casualties, in neighboring Afghanistan, which is also trying to ensure that it is moving forward on in its own democratic transition. I mean, there are crisis upon crisis, internal as well as regional and global, and we're negotiating all of this at a time when we're also negotiating one of the most critical transitions in our own history, which is the democratic transition, which brings me to your question. Of course we've had a checkered political past. It's no secret. Are we proud of it? Of course not. Are we going to do something about it? We sure as hell are going to do something about it. And we are doing something about it. But, you know, just reminding us of the past, I think, ask us about the future. I think it's much more important for us to be able to say, hey, listen, these are the four or five things we're doing to take us into a future that is going to be brighter, that is going to be democratic, and that is going to be viable and stable. But to tell us that, you know, you didn't quite do this, yeah, of course we didn't. Yeah, we didn't have democratic government throughout 57 years. Everybody knows that. What are the reasons for that? You know, we can sit down and have a seminar on it. I'd love to. Call me back.
Indeed.
But, you know, this is, I don't think this is the most appropriate forums in which you want me to address what are the reasons why, you know, we didn't have a functioning, viable democracy in Pakistan continuously for so many years. We live in a very troubled part of the world. There's no question about it. We live in a rough and tough neighborhood. It's never been a very simple neighborhood. And we've had to go and fend for our own security. I mean, that's the name of the game. When your security is under threat, nobody comes to help you. You've got to help yourself. So we went out there and got ourselves a nuclear deterrent. Did that help? Yes. Because ever since we got the nuclear deterrent, there has been no full-scale war in the subcontinent. Many people contest that. We say you have a right to your views, we have a right to our views. But leave our security to us. Don't tell us what we need to do for our security. We are the best determinants of what our security means to us. Has our security meant that we've sort of not spent enough money that we should have on the socioeconomic sectors? Of course the answer is yes. So, you know, I mean, these are obvious questions and there are obvious answers. It's tough. You know, we have to assure our security before we're able to assure anything else. And has that meant that we haven't been able to achieve many of our socioeconomic targets? The answer is yes. Our literacy rate is not what we wanted. The rate of literacy amongst women is not what we wanted. Have we allocated enough resources in the past? No. We want to do it. Why do you think we are so interested in wanting peace and stability on our border with Afghanistan and peace and stability in our border with India? Let's face it, Pakistan's geostrategic location has meant that there are certain givens in the situation. We didn't choose the neighborhood we wanted to live in. I can assure you if we could, we'd have moved house a long time ago. But we are where we are, and we've got to make the best out of a very difficult situation. And that has had its fallout, it's had its downside. But I think, you know, you have to look at what we have done in the last 5 years. We have effected one of the most remarkable economic turnarounds that have been witnessed in recent history at a time when our country was on the front lines and is still on the front lines in the war on terror in terms of Afghanistan and in terms of a border which we still have to police and put under surveillance all the time. We have, as I speak, deployed 70,000 troops on our border with Afghanistan. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of work. At a time when we're also doing other things. So, you know, it's not easy. But it's something that we are very clear about where we're going. And we are very, very confident that we'll get there.
I think...
I digressed a bit, but
you gave
me an opportunity.
No, I think you've now given three speeches. and I think three speeches... No, I'm...
There's somebody up there, huh? There's a lady up there.
Well... Are you going to take just one small clutch of questions?
No, because the lady up there.
Yeah.
I mean,
I just want to know that different government systems in the Islamic world and lack of leadership really the issue of breeding terrorism in the Islamic world?
Okay. That must be an essay you have to write. lady there. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great question. If I may address that, I think my message to Muslims, I mean, I represent, of course, Pakistan, so I cannot claim to represent Muslims in the United Kingdom. But since Pakistanis constitute, or the Pakistani diaspora constitutes the largest single group amongst Muslims in the UK, my message to them has been, go out there and do three things. Communicate, communicate, and communicate. You must engage. Please do not segregate yourself. Please do not isolate yourself. If you think that media depictions of your faith, my faith, yours, are unfair, go out there and change it. But please do not whine and crib and cry and complain and go home. Because that is of no use. You've got to go out there and engage, be part of society. You've got to be, I've always said, two Pakistanis living in this country, you can integrate without assimilating. Nobody's asking you to give up your culture and your tradition. Nobody's asking you to give up your faith. But you must be part, particularly of the political system and the political process in this country. And I'm very happy to say, I don't know how many of you know in this room, there are going to be a record number of Pakistani origin prospective parliamentary candidates in the next election, which is a source of great pride for us, because it shows that Muslims from the Pakistani diaspora are engaging, they're going out there, they may not always agree with a lot of elements of official policy, but that's fine, that's why they're there. And they're out there, I think, to define themselves, to define Muslims, so that others don't misdefine them, if I can use that word, others don't mischaracterize them. They're also out there to represent their constituents and their constituents in the wider sense of the word. Not just Pakistanis and not just Muslims, but others. And I think that's the best way to do it. There is no other way. We have no option but to engage. And I think for those who were also sort of saying that somehow, because we disagree with certain elements of policy conducted or executed by certain Western nations, we simply should, you know, throw up our hands, I think that's a cop-out. Frankly, the real challenge is how do you go out there and try to influence them to change their policy because you happen to think that that policy is having a certain deleterious effect. So whether it is internal to the United Kingdom in terms of the role of Muslims within the United Kingdom or Europe for that matter, or Muslims living in the Muslim world who have an issue on Palestine or whatever issue, we have to make sure that we are heard. We have to make sure that we continue to engage because non-engagement is frankly a non-option. It doesn't work. And it won't get you anywhere to set yourself up as some kind of an isolated island. You marginalize yourself. We, and I speak obviously for the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, we will not marginalize ourselves on the global stage, I can tell you. We're going to make our voice heard. And we have made our voice heard. Somebody asked me what we had proposed. President Musharraf, when he last met with President Bush, and this is not long ago, he met with him in December. He also came to London and met with Prime Minister Blair. Constantly he kept saying, you have to go to the heart of the matter. You have to deal with Palestine in a manner that the people of Palestine feel that what you are doing is just and legitimate and meets their aspirations. And therefore, when you say root causes, this is part of addressing. It's not all, but it's a very large part of addressing the root causes. And this the President has said publicly, President Musharraf, and he said it to President Bush, and he said it to Prime Minister Blair. Of course, we welcome the fact that Prime Minister Blair was and has been very active in this arena, and he wants to see the United States engage actively and constructively in finding a just settlement of the Middle East issue or the Middle East dispute. So I think here, all of us, and that's why I think it's so important for all of us, to be engaged in this process, because this is too serious a matter to be left to governments. It has to be done by everybody, all of us.
Okay, I think we have had a brilliant lecture and very patient and long answers to questions which were sometimes obvious. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Maliha Lodhi. One thing which has not changed at LSE is it's a crowded place and the next lecture trying to come in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ali. That was brilliant.
Gee, sure.